The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
See Derek Varn as a guest this week. Varn is the podcaster behind the Symptomatic Redness podcast and Alternatives. He's also a reader at Zero Books and a former university lecturer, now high school teacher. We discuss the current moment as one defined by anti-politics and cover a lot of ground. We talk about Angela Nagel for a bit, the DSA, and my own whiteness. It's Thursday, November 23rd, Thanksgiving Day, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast and the publisher of Zero Books. I want to remind everyone that we have a membership-only podcast, a members-only podcast, at Patreon. And I want to urge everyone to go over there, sign up for the $5 a month, and listen to the Inside Zero Books podcast. You'll hear more conversations like this one, perhaps more coherent conversations than this one. The music you're listening to right now is an instrumental version of Alice's Restaurant by Arlo Guthrie. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to C. Derek Varn and I discuss this anti-political moment.
You sign me up for a centrist Facebook group, a rationally centrist Facebook group.
Right.
You invited me to participate.
You lasted about 24 hours.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even that I got particularly annoyed. It just was not different than what I could experience in a lot of other venues. So I decided not to keep, and it was very, you know, there were a lot of posts, and I just thought, this is not really worth my time. It was not different. And I said that and got a response like, yeah, you're just a complainer or whatever. So I was like, okay, I'm really done. So, but maybe I was being Mr. Grumpy Pants, or like, you know, maybe I was being a little bit, I don't know, wrong-headed and quitting so quickly. Maybe it was more of a rage quit than I thought. Maybe I'm just so used to rage quitting now that it doesn't even register anymore when I'm doing it.
Well, I only really invited you there for the same reason I have tolerated being invited there, and that is to practice talking to people who conceive of themselves politically. The thing is that group is moderated by a centrist, but they try to quote invite people from all political persuasions who are willing to talk on a rational ground, and so that, you know, they like, I was asked there by a conservative actually, and to go in and talk to them about, you know, a different left than what they're used to arguing with. And I have been counting down I've been in there for 5 days, and I've been counting down. There has been some form of rage quit every day for 5 days. And there's been expulsions to appease people from race quitting, and they usually don't work. So there'll be a demand to expel usually a conservative who has a belief that's beyond the pale. And then the moderators do not kick them out with a morally condemnation enough. And then there's three people who rage quit because this is not a safe space or whatever.
Okay. Well, now, I don't think that's what I did. I mean, I
actually don't think that's what you did. But why you found it useless is, I think, the same reason why there's so much rage quitting.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
I didn't accuse you of rage quitting.
Right. Okay. But I just wasn't, like, I wasn't offended by anything said in the group. And I wasn't surprised by anything said in the group. And it was that second thing that made me decide to quit. That I wasn't, I mean, if I had been offended, that would have been, I mean, I've gotten sort of inured to that as well. But, so what do you think's going on? Because the idea of a reasonable center, or to put it in Zero Books speak, the idea of a normie, I think is kind of sketchy. I don't think there really are normies.
If there's such a thing as a center and a normie, it exists outside of the sphere of politics right now. The people who are engaged in it who are quote unquote normal, are not engaged in political discourse at all.
Right.
And we have assumed, because of the polarization of our media, that most people are. And there's three things that have indicated to me that this isn't true. One,
most people are politically engaged.
Aren't politically engaged, but if they're politically engaged, they're politically engaged in like some sort of sorted media landscape, right? Like that's what you hear all the time. Everything's more polarized, and in some sense that's true. What I think is more interesting about that is what I think is actually going on is politics itself is no longer political. And I want to go into what I mean by that. Because this is going to take a little bit, because I'm literally saying a category is not the category which it says it is. And that there's all kinds of anti-political responses to it, but the politics itself is also anti-political. And one of the things that I have said is that socialists can't talk to other politicos, and we also can't talk to normal people. And there's two reasons for that. One is we don't speak the language of normal people. We haven't gone about a good education program that doesn't assume, you know, the dead weight of history, in the terms of like several obscure philosophers, well, not even totally obscure, but several philosophical texts that we treat as canon. And so that's a problem. But a bigger problem is that we also can no longer talk to each other because the way we have invested ourselves into our politics. Now, this is different from, say, having a class politics or even an identity politics when the identity isn't personal. So, like, say, having black interest. Okay. This is not that. One thing I actually said, you know, people complain about ID poll a lot of the time, but a lot of what we're dealing with isn't even identity politics. It is identity morality. Politics implies that there is a social sphere in which a negotiation can happen. So, for example, when we talk about working class interest and working class politics, those wouldn't be the same things because the working class is not homogenous enough that outside of its interest, there would still be political disagreement within it. So like the idea of one Marxist party is going to represent all the interest of the working class has always been laughable because we do have more than class interest. It's just our class interests are in general, and I think probably going to stay that way, our predominant interests because they affect how we eat.
Well, I'm going to – can I insert just an aside? Just on the class interests, we have class interests, and even amongst the working class, and this is a real problem, they aren't, as class interests, always identical. We compete as workers and as capitalists or petty bourgeois.
Or even, for example, if we had working class interests, the working class interests between different regions and sectors, if you're being properly, quote, materialist, unquote, to use an oft-abuse phrase, means that what you're really doing is you're like in capitalism, there's going to be regional politics. There's a reason why I say people who work proles, who work in the oil fields are in, you know, coal mines, their unions may vote Republican. I mean, like, there's a reason for that. Because it's not just their boss's interest, that they're also, since their boss's, their interest is tied up in their boss's interest.
This is something that is very hard for Marxists to hear. That workers can identify with their bosses and not stupidly.
Right. I mean, because like, until there's an alternative beyond, on a meta level, you know, Marxism is about the large scale social conflict that drives history. But if you look at the day to day way that people have to compete in capital, that's not what actually drives most of your interactions. And I think that's something that we kind of want to ignore. No, that's a valid aside. But what that actually dooms us twofold, because if we don't have an answer for how to deal with politics that are antagonistic, even within the working class or within socialists, because, okay, working class is one set, socialist is an overlapping but separate set, let's be honest.
Yeah, right.
And a much smaller set, frankly. Mm-hmm. But even, like, we don't have a way to deal with those disagreements. You know, we don't have a way to deal with disagreements in the larger society. And you can give all your talk about revolution all day. It's going to devolve immediately into new class forms or whatever, even if you could do it, which is a big question now in another way. And if you're conceiving of a revolution in the purely old fashioned, we're going to, you know, take over the state with a bunch of guns.
Yeah.
You know, sort of way. I think we have to really look at where we are right now, because those problems are huge, but we can't even get to those problems because I've attacked the personal as political many times. Mm-hmm. But what people, when that phrase was about, was that, for example, was about like protecting like socialists protecting spousal abusers at home. You know, that's what the feminist critique was. And they weren't wrong about that. I mean, that was a real thing. But no one really foresaw, except for maybe De Boer and a few other people around the situationists. And then again, even they were wrong in some really crucial ways. The symbolic element and the representational element of self becoming so important. So what personalist political meant 30 years ago is actually not really the same thing it means now. For most people, what personalist political means is actually the political is personal. As a substitute for other forms of community, and also because of a bunch of various sorting mechanisms, which both every bourgeois sociologist and ourselves have talked about ad nauseum, we can use politics as a substitute for religion, for regional interest, for racial interest, and we try to use it for all of it.
Can I tell you a little story that my son told me about his activism on campus that sort of... Okay, so they've been trying to organize to combat tuition hikes. This is coming out of the YDS, the Young Democratic Socialists, which is a student group that's coming out of the DSA.
Right. It's the baby DSAers. I've interviewed someone from them recently, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. So Ben's involved with that. So that's where the kind of the heart of the movement to do something about tuition hikes is, I think. And what's happened is a lot of other radicals on campus have gotten involved. So they did a protest disrupting a speech that the university president, President Schill, was giving.
And, well, that's an unfortunate name.
And it backfired on them because Schill went to the press talking about how students need to understand and respect the principle of free speech because they had disrupted a speech.
And, something very similar happened even here in the red state of Utah.
Yeah, so So my response to Ben telling me about this is to say, hey, take that away from him. Talk about how free public education and free speech have to be seen together. If you can't have free speech without an educated public, and, you know, public education is a right, just like free speech is a right. Talk about it that way. And he brought that up to people. But people seemed interested in that. But then that was disrupted because the university threatened expulsion of about 10 of the activists involved. I'm not sure how many, but one or two at least. And I think it was up to 10 that they knew of. They had violated the student code, apparently. And that was there was sort of a threat of expulsion or of suspension dangling over their heads. And the response from some of the people in other organizations on campus was to say, if you're going to enforce the student code against us for being disruptive, you have to enforce it against the anti-abortion activists who are tabling on campus. They're disruptive to us because it traumatizes us to see their propaganda. So rather than trying to question the student code or get out from being, you know, out from under this threat of being suspended or expelled, they just said, yeah, no, expel them instead. And what Ben's noticed is that the people who are making this kind of mistake conceive of their politics in terms of self-care. That's what they talk about most of all.
Let me really, and I'm going to offend a lot of people. I know we have to preface. I say this a lot. Fuck you. And I mean that literally. Most of you, you know, matter a whole lot in your lives, blah, blah, blah. You're protagonist of your own story. You don't, in politics, it's not about you. Specifically not about you. Your place is a negotiation, a place for yourself in a diverse world. If you cannot conceive of that, you are not political. You are effectively on a moral crusade. And frankly, and I'm going to sound like a conservative when I say this, a narcissistic one. You know, most of politics is not about self-care. You can do that on your own. I mean, I actually miss the boomers when they would say bullshit about change yourself before you change others, because we've actually which is not necessarily smart, but we've inverted it into something even dumber. Instead of change yourself so you can change the world, we're now saying change the world so you don't have to change you.
Well, or that it will change you and your circumstances if you change the world.
That's not really what it is, though. If they were really interested in changing the situation, they would talk about the impossibleness of personal disruption as a value in a community code. Because they can get these, they can go this route of, and it's a very cynical and opportunistic route of trying to get these, you know, conservative activists expelled. But what is going to happen is they're going to be told right back from probably a larger group. That's not as loud, that they are also disruptive fundamentally. And so now instead of, you know, they might get the other group expelled, or what's more likely to happen is they're going to get everything defunded and tuition hikes are going to go up anyway. Because politicians who have the purse strings on this and donors have the purse strings on this are going, this is ridiculous. You know, like you can't listen to an anti-abortion activist. I mean, and I'll be honest with you, of all the left-wing positions that you're going to fight, that's the most contentious, but it's also, frankly, the one where you have the least public sympathy of all of them. Like, on every, like you can read all these Pew polls and stuff where the population has a much more progressive view on things like tax policy and even anti-racism than what you get from listening to political discourse. You do not get that on abortion. It is literally 50-50.
And the public isn't dumb on this. I mean, it's not as easy as a problem as we like to pretend it is either. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm not pro-choice. I'm pro-choice.
No, most people are pro-choice, but they're not as absolutist about it. It's like pro-choice is the dominant. I don't think it's truly 50. This is like 60-40, actually. But pro-choice is the dominant opinion. But if you start getting down on things like late-term abortion bans and stuff, you actually do start to see increasingly more and more people have more questionable morality on it. It's not the same. And what's weird is it's not the same way. Like, say, gay marriage has been completely one-directional, for example, with the exception of a loud religious majority. But it's a loud religious minority, but it is very much a minority. That is not the case on abortion. So abortion, like, let's see.
No, abortion is absolutely the worst target that they could have picked to say it was disruptive. It's absolutely the worst because it is actually a live political topic, one that hasn't really been completely settled, and a contentious one where debate and thought, free thought, at least to my liberal mindset, seems necessary.
Yeah, and I mean, it's in it, and I just looked it up, so I got the Gallup polls on this. So in 2016, it is 50% pro-choice, 44% pro-life, which means there's 6% of the population that is undecided. For one, this is one thing where the people are truly polarized. While a majority of women are pro-choice, it is only 54%.
Right.
Pro-choice idea amongst Democrats has swelled since 2001, so they've almost kicked off all the pro-life Democrats out of the party. But even there, it's only 66%. So even if you sort amongst people who identify politically as Democrats, you're only up to 66% of the population. So that's a live political issue. It's one that's going to be extremely polarizing, and it will be used against them. And it won't – it also – I don't imagine how these people think this politics will play out in other parts of the country. Or they just don't care.
They don't care.
They
don't care about how the politics play out in their own campus. They don't even care if they get suspended or expelled. Or can't conceive of that actually happening to them.
Right. They don't think that – I think they think that it's going to be so ludicrous to expel these – to expel these anti-abortion activists that either that they'll change it, which is okay, maybe, or that I don't know what they think, actually.
I don't think they think that. I think they think that I don't think they are considering consequences at all. At all.
Okay, but now
– These are – the act of the demand is an end in itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's my view, that – what they're doing is signaling. I hate to, but it's not just signaling. It's beyond that. They're reacting and they're expressing. That's probably better. They're expressing their inner conviction, and that's all that matters.
Right. And so that's what I noticed in this group. And it wasn't while it was more liberal leaning people than socialist or conservatives, you saw it all in all the slides. Like, I did see people go, well, this is too pro-feminist, we're done, you know. Or look at these anti-racists, they're rage quitting, and they're going to block us from doing anything, so we're just going to do the same thing and quit too, because there's no reason to have this dialogue. And what's very hard to argue with these people is they're not wrong. There is nothing that's going to come out of that dialogue, because the presumption of morality is of the morality of your position. That is, and this I'm going to attack some liberal policy wonky ideas. That has always precluded debate. That is a commitment fait accompli. Like, once you've made that commitment, yes, you can change, but while you are under that commitment, you cannot debate those points. And a lot of those points they're not easily reconcilable. Like, and there's a lot of thought cliches on all sides that have been very effective at keeping people loyal to their identity. People who oppose abortion just hate women. That's super. I hear it all the time. You hear it on atheist podcasts, like, only religious people oppose abortion. That's not even true. Everybody gets that there are people. I do think that you would see the secular support for pro-choice is much higher than the religious, but that's just not. You couldn't say that 46% of the female population in the United States is misogynistic in that clear sense. I mean, that would be really hard to argue. That would be arguing that in a group of 10 women, that basically four of them and half of one hate themselves. And those things only work if you already believe, and they also work as a way to shut down discourse. But here's what I want to get at too. These people also are not really willing to fight. Anti-fostic fighting, whatever. You know, that's a lot of, that's, you know, willingness to fight, but that's not really willingness to fight. That's not long serve sustained battle, because that would compromise your sense of self. You'd have to do things in a political battle or in a revolutionary battle that breaks your sense of morality. There's no way around it. All right. Like, I don't think this stuff is politics at a certain point. I don't think, because it's not even war. It's meme war. It is the simulacra of war, but it is not even war, because we don't think, like, what is this going to do? Okay, some kids might get kicked out. It'll suck for them. Everybody else will get to feel self-righteous. The university will go on as it is. It will continue to neoliberalize. It will continue to crush its faculty, which, by the way, a lot of the people who are involved in these student protests don't really support either. So even though the faculty is probably on their side most of the time, and you're all right, because I mean, like, there's been whole kinds of faculty protest lately about even things as mundane as exams. And there's been a rhetoric, for example. So my favorite bit of counterintuitive rhetoric, and I've been pointing out the left doing, like, the liberal left doing this for years. This was my dealings in education when they were, like, teaching time preferences racist. That was in the Seattle school board, because it was a white value and a privileged right. But my most recent one is this recent turn that even I've seen even leftists laugh at, that mathematics is inherently white privilege. And so instead of increasing black and female representation in mathematics, we should change the field of mathematics and not teach it and not require it for things like community college, which I'm my fundamental thing is, you're just making the community college degree less valuable. Like, how can you not see that? Like, you're pretending like that changing the curriculum changes the way that society sorts it. That's not how it works.
On what basis do they say that mathematics is a white value?
That white people do better than black people at it. I mean, but all, you know, they don't. I don't hear stuff about like how Asian countries do better than the U.S. at it or anything like that. I mean, but
it's not historically at all, you know, part of the white cultural heritage exclusively at all.
I guess maybe there's some thought that we don't teach enough I have heard some arguments about how we don't teach enough Indian and Arabic mathematicians, but I'm like, we don't teach many mathematicians, period. like you can get a math degree and, you know, not know who Pythagoras really was. And although even then the idea that Pythagoras was – that Pythagoreanism is clearly white is an anachronistic concept. Like,
right.
You know.
No, it's totally ludicrous, really.
Because, you know, Asia Minor is totally white, even though we're talking about the era that would be from Greece to the Arab world. Like – I guess that's – I get, but, you know, whiteness is another thing that comes up a lot in that rationally centered group. People can't even agree on what they mean by it. They throw around the term white people – and even moderates do – white people dismissively all the time. But there is this large argument by a young white anti-racist about how, like anti-Semitism was irrelevant to that because anti-Semitism is anti-religious. And I was like – that's misreading our current racial categories into racial categories 100 years ago. Like, whiteness was not even the first people to come up with the concept of like a right race, except in Anglo-speaking world, that was never a common way to conceive it. Like, that came out of England and France almost solely, and it was during mercantile and settler colonial developmental times. But even there, like who is defined as white is changing constantly. And it's different, and it's still different between the UK and the US. So these ideas, I mean, and it's weird because these are the same people that talk about race as a social construction, right? But they're trans historically reading our current notions of race back in history. Why? Because they're trans-historicizing their own fucking identity. Like, so, again, like, this is not directly related to politics, but you can't, it's, like, these people, like, I say these people, but, I mean, these activists, and I don't think it's just liberals or left liberals either. Like, they're looking at things completely ahistorically, and they're completely opportunistic about when they're being sociologically nuanced. So, you know, all these smart people will point out, you know, well, the ancient Roman and Greek world wasn't really white. Well, yeah, we just realized that, but then when you were attacking us teaching classical culture because of dead white men, you just ignored that. And it's the same groups of people talking about both. So I'm like, so you can't have your nuance and eat it too. You are completely virtue signaling without any coherent view. And the reason why I say this is important is when you don't have a coherent definition of what you are trying to defend, you can defend your popular sentiment because that's a tribal instinct. And this is going to backfire hardcore, because what we're increasingly seeing is the de and anti-politicization of large strata of young people, of working class people, of otherwise marginalized people. Because it's not just that, like, there's all these reports that Generation Z, for example, the generation that's under 19 now. That in the main they're actually more conservative than the millennials were. Now I am skeptical about that, because I remember in 2004 the millennials were supposed to be the most conservative generation. All right. Yeah. Well. Here's the thing: you can't predict trends. So what we saw in 2004 was we were reading the people tend to reflect their larger social milieu, and their social milieu in 2004 was the Bush years and just after 9/11. Now, there are some trends that millennials have. I don't really believe in generational politics, but if you look at people who were born particularly after 1985, so it's not even all millennials, it's like millennials who are younger than me, they tend to trust institutions more than Gen Xers and older millennials do. And that trait is also amongst Gen Z, and that is across the board, conservative, liberal, whatever. They basically trust the state. The same people who were protesting Black Lives Matter were trying to use things like...
Protesting with or against Black Lives Matter.
We had Black Lives Matter, so like John Lewis, you know, in Atlanta, you know, the congressional members who were, and I'm speaking normie politics for now, normie politics in quotation marks, who were congressionally supportive of Black Lives Matter, also supported things like a gun bill that based it off the do not, you know, that based gun bans based off the no fly list, right? So like it was an anti-racist bill to promote gun bans that were based on a Bush era kind of explicitly racialized law that disproportionately affected Muslims. So like, I was like, I was just shocked that there was so little outrage about this. And like, you had John Lewis and Elizabeth Warren holding hands in the Senate about it. You know, so people do have more faith in institutions, and you see this even in a lot of the anti, you know, a lot of the, I must say, Black Lives Matter. I'm becoming very hesitant to even use that term, because when we talk about Black Lives Matter, I don't know who we're talking about. It's a brand. There's a couple of groups that claim it. But so the campus groups that claimed it, particularly the ones in the Ivy League 2 years ago, most of what they appealed to against this administration was to expand administrative power. So, like, they were going to require...
But that doesn't explain why people are doing... More people are committing suicide, and more people are committing suicide by attacking the police, death by cop.
But my death by cop thing, you're misconfusing me. Like, death by... Like, you are first likely to kill yourself by doing it yourself. Then your next way to die is by cops. That's actually by gun deaths.
Oh, okay. I just think of death by cop as an intentional act.
Yeah, death by cop. Yeah. I mean, you can keep this in, but my own brother tried to commit suicide that way, so I understand. He was not shot. He's white, so not going to help anyone's narrative. Then he shot himself in the face and lived through it. But suicides are going up exponentially, and particularly amongst young people. Like, I work at now, it's really bad in the Mountain West. I don't know why. Partly because it's whiter, if you look at the statistics on racial relationship to suicide. Partly because of uneducated white people, particularly low education white people, particularly likely kill themselves. But just in general, teenagers. We made some headway against suicide in the 90s. That's all been reversed and expanded upon. So the average murder rate in the United States is 4 per 100,000. The average suicide rate is 9 to 100,000. And in places like Colorado, Utah, and upper New Mexico, it's the suicide rate amongst teenagers is up to 22 per 100,000. So like that suicide rate is worse than the rate of, say, homicides in the Carter war stricken areas of Mexico. And it's very hard to explain. I mean, the opioid crisis is another thing, and we don't talk about we talk about it a little bit, but it's very interesting that we don't talk about it for what it is. It's not the opiate crisis. It's not these people are dying of heroin and cocaine. It's the opioid crisis. They're dying of things that are manufactured by capitalists and are legal. Not legal for them to take, but legal to be produced. So, like, these are not Schedule III drugs. So, I think all these things right now are led to a very anti-political moment. And if you were to say... Like, I think Trump is an anti-political turn, right? So how did Trump win? Was his strategic winning very specific areas. Like, he was very strategic about what areas they really focused on winning. The Electoral College, using that to their ability, which Republicans have gotten much better at using. And in this ways, and in some ways, I think not movement conservatism and not the alt-right or alt-white, but traditional conservatives are actually the only people who seem to still have a politics left, because they think strategically. And they do know how to kind of engage with the other side. They know how to coach with. And I learned that from talking, because, like, you know, I live in Utah. It's an overwhelmingly Republican state, and they're very good at code switching when talking to the public about stuff, like even stuff like minimum wage laws and stuff, and you know, workers' compensation laws and expanding healthcare access. They speak all that very well. Our discourse online, Angela Nagel the other day was saying, like, well, I don't believe these online groups are representative of the real political discourse. I wanted to say to her, bullshit. You're being incredible. Where's this real political movement that isn't online? Where does it exist? Where is it? Like, if we want to say that this is not representative of the way people actually think, and I actually agree with you, it isn't. It's not because there's another real political movement that exists out there. People just don't know and don't care. And what I was going to bring up to you, I mean, you know, since I teach high school in the States now, I mentioned Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring to my teenage kids. Now, they would have admittedly been about – so they're seniors now. They would have been about sixth grade when that started. They knew not a damn thing about it.
Did they know the words? Did they know anything?
They didn't even know what Occupy really meant, for the most part. They did. They didn't know about the Arab Spring at all. They did know a little bit about Black Lives Matter. They didn't have strong opinions. This is mostly white school. It's a disproportionately for Utah minority heavy school, minority heavy in quotations. But I mean, like, it's still 30%. It's still only 30% minority, which for, again, Utah is a lot. But
yeah,
for like me, who grew up in, like, you know, quote minority majority areas, like the deep south in the semi-urban areas, like, that's nothing, you know.
Well, look, I agree with you about Angela Nagel missing the boat on the import of online politics. Not that it is politics, but
no, it signals something, though. Yeah. It's not just that these people are like nerds in their basement. They are, but I have minor criticisms of Angela, and they're all basically small things. Like, well, they're not small, but
they're just different. I mean,
they're completely different than what I hear. Right?
Yeah.
What I hear is thrown at her is a lot of the stuff that's frustrating us, because it's just entirely in moral categories, and sometimes, to be completely honest, in moral categories that don't even really apply, because, like, some of the misreadings are profoundly unfair.
Right. Recently, she was accused of being gross about Zoe Quinn. You know who she is?
So what does it mean politically to be gross or cringy? Like, I hear this all the time amongst kids now. I'm like, well, but what does that actually mean? It means you don't like it? It means you have an adverse reaction to it? Like, let's break down what that language means.
In fact, that's all it means. Well, what it means is she wasn't Like, she wasn't holding up Zoe Quinn as any kind of leader for any kind of political movement or as a significant character on the left.
Right. Basically, she sees Zoe Quinn's battle as a culture war that is a left. And when I mean a left, as in, like, not left. Like, it's not right either. It is a different issue.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And so she probably isn't on either side of that battle, but, it, you know, she certainly is skeptical of the Zoe Quinn side of that battle. And I mean, my God, you know, Angela Nagel, she doesn't, and she probably still holds on to some lowbrow, highbrow distinctions. And so, like, you know, getting involved in video game war and championing one side of that, just not something she's likely to do, you know? So let's go back to this anti-political moment that we're in and what it means to be anti-political. What does it mean for a socialist?
Well, for a socialist to be anti-political is basically a right-wing term. And I also would say that a lot of the, to me, a lot of the responses to it are also sort of right-wing. I mean, you and I both reluctantly agreed in a podcast. I say reluctantly only because it made me uncomfortable to say that in some ways Chomsky's old idealism, you know, some things he says about Antifa that I don't agree with seem to me more left-wing than the idea that, say, the Democrats are a shitty workers' party, even though I think materially Chomsky's politics and those kind of soft DSA politics are very, very similar as far as what they actually advocated you do. But that at least one had an ideal vision that was fundamentally more radical than the ideal vision of the DSA, which is actually realpolitik. The DSA exists because it feels that there is no way to have a socialist party in the United States. And I know that I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but its very rationale from existence, from the reason why Harrington formed it out of the ashes of the SPA, was because they felt, and why they did not join the SPUSA, which was the other successor organization, was that they felt the SPUSA was being delusional about the possibility of a non-bourgeois socialist political party in the United States. And that the only thing you could do was build a space for socialism within a bourgeois political party. And that then you could use that as a platform for socialism itself. But that is why the DSA has never claimed to be a party. And that is why, even though it is a successor to the same organization as the SPUSA, it was not the same thing as it. While you could be a member of both organizations, I believe, I think I know people who are, they have always had different agendas and a different underlying philosophy. And the DSA right now has several, many, many, including like anarchist sub-factions and basically crypto-Marxist-Leninist sub-factions, people who don't even believe in the DSA's real platform against centralism, which is a part of its platform. Both of those parties share – I said party again, see, because even I have trouble with it. But both the activist order of the DSA and the political party SPUSA banned centralism. But there are centralist organizations within it. The DSA has no – programmed on which to kick them out. And since the DSA's convention, I think all we've seen from it is scandal after scandal after fuck up after scandal. And that is after I think it moved in the right direction on a couple of key issues, but it couldn't break away it would not formally break away from the Democrats. And it's now gone into the same sort of morality policing that you see in liberal organizations. So there's a lot of, you know, disclaiming about, I mean, some of it's, I'm not going to say it's illegitimate. It's not, but it seems like it's fighting the same culture wars everything else is, but downstream. So in a way it's all these people are moving into an organization that can't really politicize itself beyond the Democratic Party's left flank at a time when the Democratic Party, in the last 2 weeks in particular, is openly purging its left flank.
Right.
So, like, So we're running into, you're running into an organization that's going to attempt to move a larger party to the left that has no mechanism to do.
Right.
So it is not properly speaking. I mean, even the DSA, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but even the DSA, then its politics are not properly political. What are you actually achieving? Were you doing some local stuff? Okay, so you might be locally political, but on the national level, what are you able to do? And that is...
Did you hear my interview with Adam Proctor? At one point, I still a little, you know, what I remember from that was when I was asking him what the DSA is for, he sort of said it is a social club for like-minded people, a way to connect.
Yeah, and again, who the fuck cares?
He wasn't saying it proudly or anything. You just accurately, or if he,
I think he's being honest, right?
Yeah.
Like, but at the same, like, so you have a very large social club. I mean, like, you know, I'm a member of social clubs, man. I mean, like I'm a member of even religious organizations. Like, come on, you know. For example, I've actually talked to about this a lot of times. I think a lot of socialists have, since charity is not. An answer that you shouldn't give it. And I've always thought that was kind of a cop-out. It's like, it's not an answer. That's not why you do it. Like, you know, and you can have the dialectical and both, as opposed to the either or. So, you know, when I say dialectical there, like, you synthesize that, like, you know. So in many ways, I actually – God, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. I live like a conservative in my relationship to things like charity and ethical consumerism. Like, I don't think ethical consumerism really works. I still somewhat do it. I don't do it for political reasons because I know it doesn't work. It is a discipline for me to remind myself what my values are.
Right. It's an identity function.
Right, but you notice I don't ever talk about that as a political function. Those are separate things.
Right, yeah.
Like I very much believe in, like, you know, in my interpersonal relationship being as egalitarian as absolutely possible, and I also believe that as a political virtue, but my personal way of handling it and my political way of handling it are related, but they're not the same. And I think we've collapsed all that in. Like, you know me, I talk to people even you won't tolerate. Like, I talk to people who are pretty far right. It does not mean that I agree with them. it is just so that I can understand how these political conceptions are going on. And sometimes it's even hard for me. Like, I see anti-Semitic shit on my wall. It's hard for me to let that go. I try to. All right. And I do it not because I think these people are good people. You know, some of them are, you know, some of them are just misguided, but some of them are objectively scare me personally and politically. But I need to know how they think, and I need to be able to dialogue with them, you know, to understand how they think, because I'm going to have to be able to fight them at a certain point. If I shut them all out, I can't understand how they're organizing, thinking, moving around or whatever. And yeah, it does mean you have to be uncomfortable. And yeah, you sometimes have to suck up to people who you think have objectively scummy beliefs. Like, but you have to do it.
It's really tricky because the people who are making this argument most vociferously right now range from the DSA to the center of the Democratic Party. That I listen to anyway. Here's my problem with everything that we've been saying so far. When you start to try to be political and you're trying to win people to your point of view, there are sacrifices you make that aren't just about your personal morality. It also, you make some sacrifices as to what you think the scope of your political vision could be. And, you know, I feel as though it's absolutely an imperative to reach out to people and to communicate with people who aren't exactly like you and have a different identity or different set of moral signals or symbols around their identity. But I also worry that we're going to fall into electoralism.
Well, we already have. I mean, we already have. And here's the thing. If we are honest about our politics, and let's be fair, I don't think most people are honest. There is no way for you to operate in our current world without some concessions to electoralism, if even to create the space for more revolutionary things to happen. Because what do we see happening to groups that don't engage in any electoralism?
They become sects. They become cults.
They become cults. They feed themselves. They don't do anything outside of it. They denounce people outside of themselves. And a lot of times, even like, let's be honest from our experience, and we're not going to name names here, they actually actively support the status quo.
That has happened. Yeah.
So like they will be afraid of, they would rather have a moderate that they see as maintaining the current trajectory than a risk from a left or right wing populist or whatever that would truly change things because of the marginality of certain groups, you know, being at risk. And that's in somewhat a fair concern in some ways, but at the same time, what that actively means is your politics are not only not really revolutionary, they're not even really marginally interested in changing anything. They are ultimately very safe and very conservative. And that's also why people aren't afraid of those groups. Like, it's not like they send COINTELPRO out to mess with those groups because they don't fucking matter. Like, they're going to write another polemic on the internet that 200 people are going to read. Who cares?
So do you see the battle right now being in the Democratic Party and to try to hold on to whatever we can still get out of the Bernie Sanders? So where's the battle politically or electorally?
Our battle right now has to be legislatively, and it's not going to have to do with parties, and it actually has to do with thinking in terms of interest. Those interests right now are going to largely overlap with the Democratic Party, but they wouldn't always. And that's something that I think people like just don't get. We have to be willing to challenge a Democratic Party in certain areas, in certain states, even if it meant the risk of a right-wing candidate winning. Because otherwise, you have no incentive for the center to create space for you. They will always create space to the right because they will get disinfected former rightists, you know, former conservatives who are scared by the current right to go their way easier than picking us up. It is based off of the false belief that most people are moderates. Because most people aren't that political. They're not a moderate is a political mindset on a certain spectrum.
Yeah, being apolitical is not the same thing as being moderate.
Moderate, yeah. And if anything, I'm saying that it's not just apolitical. A lot of people becoming anti-political. They don't trust the conception of politics that exists, period. And that is a different – and I'm literally arguing with someone about this right now. That is a different thing than depoliticization.
A couple of things are really frustrating to me. One is that I'm constantly being attacked on this issue of whiteness. Because it is very difficult to respond to. I really wish that we could, because I'm tired of being in this position where I feel like I'm any way defending the concept, right? But it seems like whiteness or maleness are what people attack when they're trying to attack you for pushing any sort of universal politics. Any kind of universalizing politics gets attacked as white or male.
Romani and Jews and used to be the Irish, although not anymore. White Catholics, if they weren't German. We were a threat to a universalizing order. Okay? And so like the tension between Jews and as Jews and Jews as just people in the French in the French Enlightenment is a real question that I think the left hasn't really been able to deal with. You've talked to Moshe Prestone about left anti-Semitism. He points out that there's a tension in the universalism there. There really is a tension in the universalism there. That tension is never going to go away. And with groups with black groups and Latinx group and all these other groups, that's not going to go away either, except that some of those groups, say Latinx, half of them could become white tomorrow, really, if you know, because it's not really a skin tone issue. It's a cultural one. And as people become more culturally ingrained, those differences are less and less obvious. Half of the community, that isn't true because they're indigenous, but they were actually at a disadvantage in their quote home countries unquote anyway. So there is a real tension there here. But my point about that is that tension has to be handled handled politically within the context of what a socialist politics will look like. All right. That's not going to be solved. So I have to advocate for myself politically. I advocate for things I believe would be universally good, both within capitalism. Okay, so if I vote at a given time, and I don't think my vote really matters, but if I did, and within socialism as we bring it into being, those are actually, A, they're two separate questions, and B, those are both separate questions from how we would deal with this tension between the universal and particular once we're out of capitalism. Because I don't think we can have a clear-cut answer for that. And I understand the distrust for that. The only appeal that I have, and you and I often fight about this minorly, I don't have a principled appeal for that. I just have a practical one. If you live in a society where you are a minority, and that isn't going to change, and also if you assume that all minority interests aren't the same, which you really probably should, and a lot of people try not to avoid that question, what do you really like? Where are you most likely to get support for your needs from? What are your interests more likely to be supportive from? Is it supportive for you as a particular or for you as a universal group? And that question does differ depending on the question. So when it comes to economics, I think it really is clear that you're going to be better off advocating for the universal subject. when it comes to things like police violence, I think that's actually a little bit more murky. Not that it isn't clear, because like I said, white people are still the majority of people who get killed by cops, but not the proportions are completely off if you are it off of
people. My view on that is, if you want to do something about the disproportionality of police violence, you're going to have to do something about the economic disproportionality. And that's not necessarily going to be immediately beneficial to the majority. You know, you're going to have to invest in infrastructure spending in areas which are majority black.
Well, yeah, of course. But again, if you invested in infrastructure spending in areas that are majority poor, you're going to be support for the infrastructure. You can get support for the infrastructure spending that's majority black. If you tie – this is going to be really important with the increasing – rural poverty divide. That's not going to go away. That development is something that's happening within capital because of capital workflows. I'm going to sing the praises of Berdiga. I have many critiques of him as I get older, but this one's something he actually pointed out that socialists hadn't dealt with, was that there is going to be an increasing divide between rural and urban. And that until you handle that divide in some kind of logistic way, you're always going to have separate class interests, even within the working class, because those are profoundly different spheres of economic transaction. All right. Right now, in the representative republics that we currently see, the majority is actually really disenfranchising itself by running into cities. But if you're going to get sympathy from that, from the cities, you have to be willing to reinvest in agricultural infrastructure, which would help these other areas, if you did it in a way that discouraged agribusiness, which really requires socialism, see? But you know, so like you have to actually think of politics completely differently. But that has to be addressed, or this is only going to get worse. And this is where what I'm trying to say, we live in an anti-political moment, because most people's conception of politics is not just depoliticizing, it is anti the ability to do anything political. And I don't just mean electorally, I mean like socially too. And the social sphere is necessarily a political sphere. There are things that are not political in the social sphere, which again, I don't really want to get into all that, because that's a fine tooth comb issue. But if you can't deal with politics beyond conceptions of self and immediate groupings, and I mean very immediate groupings, you can't really do anything political. Like, you just can't, because you're going to put it all on moral grounds. It'll be grandstanding. You'll be ignored. And what we are seeing in the current way things are developing is this: more and more people are, in both parties in the United States, and you see it across the world, more and more people are just not factored into the equations of how these parties think, because they don't matter. And a lot of these lifestyle postures only matter in election years, and then they immediately go away.
Why have we gotten to this point where it's so hard to think politically?
My intuitive answer is that as political as the self has become more symbolic and representative and decommunitized for a lot of reasons, and politics has become more representative, kind of separately for other reasons, like that this is the sphere that we all exist in. And it's a sphere that can mean a whole lot to individuals. It means very little to society. And if you have a whole lot of people who are otherwise engaged in that, guess what they're not engaged in doing? So like in this sense, there really is an opportunity cost that people are not. And so it's going to be encouraged. And the nature of our media has only made it worse. Like all this, like no one is afraid of lifestyle radicalism. Let's be honest. Like religious people are afraid, but like Facebook isn't afraid of that. It can totally handle that. It can, and in fact, it gives them another way to market to you.
Right.
Right. They can more specialize their ads. So it's factored in. And we've been saying that for years, but I don't think we've really seen what it really, I haven't really seen what it meant until the last two or three.
Yeah.
Like how far this actually goes. Because I think a lot of people's self is defined by the way they represent themselves. And what a lot of people say is self-care isn't even psychological care. If it was actually effective, suicide rates would be going down. It's not. So this self-care is not – doesn't seem particularly effective. And I've actually looked it up. It's very hard to find statistics on this. But some statistics on if you look at like famous activists and stuff, they're even more likely to commit suicide than teenagers.
Really?
So yeah, I mean, it's just not. Now again, it's a subset of famous activists, so there's pressures of fame too. But famous activists does not mean the same thing as like famous. You could be pretty marginal and be a famous activist.
Would we count Mark Fisher in that category?
Yes, we would. We count. And if you look at those from a couple of informal studies, there haven't been a formal study, because how would you even define that, right? There's not a good strong parameter to define that. But some informal studies I've seen has indicated that the suicide rate amongst left activists is pretty high. That should tell us something about this self-care talk, because it means that it doesn't seem to be working.